Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I'm Joseph.
And I'm Nick.
This is Fish Jelly. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay.
Yeah.
This is from like earlier in the week, but did you see that comment Barbara Streisand left on one of Melissa McCarthy's Instagram posts?
Something about Ozempic. I saw there was a blow up about it, and she said she was trying to give her a compliment or something.
Yeah, there, Melissa McCarthy posted a picture of her with Adam Shankman, and Barbara Streisand commented underneath, "Give him my regards. Did you take Ozempic?" Not realizing that it wasn't, like, that was a public comment.
Oh.
So then Barbara Streisand tweeted, "Oh my God, I went on Instagram to see the photos we'd posted of the beautiful flowers I'd received for my birthday. Below them was a photo of my friend Melissa McCarthy, who I sang with on my Encore album. She looked fantastic. I just wanted to pay her a compliment. I forgot the world is reading." And then, of course, Melissa McCarthy basically said, like, she's so flattered that Barbara Streisand even knows she exists and is just trying to pay her a compliment, so it's not a big deal. But I thought it was funny, like, how people, like, y'all want to drag Barbara Streisand. Like, that's an older lady and who was clearly not trying to be messy and people act like they don't have family who say and do wild shit.
Right.
And you don't call them out. But then this stranger who's commenting on another stranger, like, you don't know either of these people, and then you're on social media
mad. I do think it's in of note that Melissa McCarthy's weight comes up periodically, that there's a some kind of minor cultural kerfluffle about her weight or how she's dressing.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, she's a notable person, so.
No, but you know, like, that asshole Rex Reed talking about Identity Thief, I think he was saying shitty things, and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, but overwhelmingly, I thought it was funny because it feels like something. I feel like most of us, our moms say things, well, at least mine does, like these weird compliments that are more triggering than anything. Mm-hmm. Like, so to me, it sounded very familiar. I feel like my mom says a lot of things that are in a similar vein, like, "Oh, you think you're being nice, but you're just being nosy and it's triggering me."
Yeah, it's like, why do you have to tell me that right now?
Yeah. But that's all. Then Kim Fields, the actor, who's currently on the Netflix show The Upshaws, which is a pretty big hit for Netflix. She was on The Breakfast Club. And I've liked her for a long time. I remember watching her on Facts of Life, and of course I love Living Single, and I really like The Upshaws. But anyway, I watched her interview, and she had a couple of cute stories. One was that Charlamagne, so Kim Fields' mom is Chip Fields, who is an actor. She did a lot of TV and theater, and I think Chip Fields is best known for playing Penny's mom on Good Times.
Oh, yes. I did know that.
Penny is, of course, Janet Jackson's character on Good Times.
Yeah, she abuses her.
And Chip Fields plays her mom. And it's such an iconic character that really was only on four episodes. Mm-hmm. But for people who don't know, Janet Jackson as Penny on Good Times was this girl who's like an 8-year-old, and her mother physically abuses her. And there's a scene where her mother, played by Chip Fields, burns her with an iron, like a hot iron. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, is taken away from her mom. And that's how that character of Penny is integrated into the show Good Times for like the final two or three seasons. But anyway, Charlamagne, the God, one of the hosts of The Breakfast Club, asks Kim Fields, like, "What did you think as a young girl, like, watching your mom do this thing?" And she told a cute story that, you know, I know people saw that and might have thought like, oh, this woman's so scary. But you have to remember that I got to see my mom like rehearse this. So she was saying for like a couple of weeks before they shot that scene, LaToya Jackson would bring Janet Jackson to Chip and Kim's apartment in Studio City and mm-hmm. they would rehearse. So she got to watch her mom with this other little girl reenact the scene over and over again. So by the time she saw it, it was just like, oh, I'm, you know, like it was no big deal. Mm-hmm. But I think Janet and Kim Fields are friends because.
Yeah, because I swear she's told that story before.
I had never heard it, but I, you know, periodically, like whenever Janet's on tour or is doing press, you'll see like Kim Fields will post like, oh, I went to go see my girl backstage, or
she often pops up. You were watching something and Kim Fields had gone to some appearance Janet made and was talking about how she knew her.
Yeah, well, I mean, her mom, Kim Fields' mom, played Janet Jackson's mom, and they're the same age. And, yeah. You know, they both were child actors. And so it would make sense that that they know each other. But she had kind of another Janet-related story, because Janet, a couple of weeks ago, was on the Drew Barrymore show. And they asked her if she regrets, like, was there ever a role? No, they asked her, is it true that you turned down a role in The Matrix? And she said, no. But actually, I think you're confusing that with another role I turned down. So Janet says that she was offered the role of Storm in X-Men, mm-hmm. that of course Halle Berry played. But then Drew Barrymore said, oh, I turned down a role. I don't know what role it was because I haven't seen Boogie Nights, but she turned down some role in Boogie Nights.
Probably Heather Graham.
To play or to do the movie Ever After. Mm-hmm. But Kim Fields, so then they asked on the Breakfast Club, they asked Kim Fields, oh, was there ever a role that you turned down that became iconic? And she said, no, but I have kind of a fun story in reverse. She said that she got a call saying that she was offered or being considered for the role of Storm in X-Men. So then, and she had already heard that like Halle Berry, mm-hmm. Or it might have been Halle Berry had already done the first one. And now she was thinking, oh, like Halle Berry doesn't want to do it anymore. So they're calling Kim Fields. So Kim Fields says that she went down to this audition and tried to dress kind of like Storm. And she was all excited and thought that it was crazy that they would consider her. Mm-hmm. And when she got there, she realized that it was for the animated series to do the voice.
Well, she got into the spirit of the thing.
She did, but I thought that was cute.
Her mother, notable to me, was also in Paul Schrader's debut film,
Claudine.
Blue Collar.
Oh, Blue Collar?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And she's also in the, you know, I've never seen The Happy Hooker.
Oh, well, Chip Fields is in Claudine.
Yeah,
in like a small role.
Bit part, yeah.
Yeah, but she did a lot of TV. She actually played, on Facts of Life, I believe, as Kim Fields' daughter. And then she was on Living Single as Kim Fields' daughter, Regine's daughter, or mother. So she's been a big part of her daughter's career and life. And Chip Fields is still alive. She does.
She directs too.
Yeah, but she's also like a dialogue coach, which I think is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the cats come to terrorize us. Moving on. I wanted to complain about people who go to movie theaters
yeah.
and get their old buttery ass popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Like we'll sit at the butter station and just dump a gallon of butter. And then they put that popcorn, like people will put the popcorn on the seat next to them.
Yeah.
I think that's so inconsiderate, because that old greasy ass popcorn is on this, like, especially when the seats are not fabric. You know, sometimes they're like that man-made plastic leather type shit so that they're wipeable.
Mm-hmm.
So that means like if you get that seat greasy, the grease is just sitting on there. So then the next person who goes to sit down
will have grease particles. For
yeah.
Sure.
People are trash. Those are the same people who take their shoes off in the airplane and then put their feet up on the mm-hmm. center armrest.
That's right. Drag them.
That's just nasty.
It is. People don't have any etiquette, or they think people aren't watching or don't care. Well, don't care, clearly. But
so if you do that, shame on you.
You know what's worse, though? On a recent flight I was on, I had a layover somewhere, St. Louis, and there was a woman behind me clearly sick and coughing the whole time. Like those little coughs. Like I was so mad.
Yeah, that's awkward because, you know, some people feel like, well, I have to get to where I'm going. And
so, no,
but then people don't really make an effort, like put a mask
on. Well, it's like, yeah, put your do something,
to show something,
like we can all hear you.
But anyway, moving on to the restaurant section, we tried a new restaurant called Joyce.
Yes.
Which is in downtown LA. Mm-hmm. It's off Grand. It's in the same kind of structure as the Whole Foods in downtown LA. Mm-hmm. And I knew we had walked by that space a number of times, and I guess I never considered any of those restaurants as like places I'd want to go. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
Well,
probably because of the parking,
and they're on the expensive side.
But it didn't occur to me like, oh, just park in the Whole Foods parking, which is what we did. Mm-hmm. We did buy something at Whole Foods, so it's not like I totally cheated the system. But anyway, Joyce is a restaurant that is, the menu centers around soulful Southern fare, mm-hmm. with an emphasis on sustainable seafood, offering an extensive raw bar program and selection of fine American caviars. So from the sound of that, you can predict that it was spendy.
Yes.
But I thought the food was really good.
I liked everything that we got.
You got the duck confit, and it was funny because it wasn't cheap. And they gave you, I mean, ducks aren't big, but you got a little duck thigh.
I got duck leg.
And then, of course, you were like, when I'm in Toronto or wherever.
Berlin.
For half this price, I get an entire duck.
Yeah, I get a whole big duck breast at some of those Chinese restaurants.
But, I mean, the flavor was really good. We got their mac and cheese. That was good. It was served in like a hot skillet. Mm-hmm. And of course, the best part is all the cheese that gets burned to the skillet. We got some cornbread, which was really good. Mm. Some catfish. They had an interesting dish. It was like, I've never had green cauliflower. Mm-hmm. Or did they paint that cauliflower?
No, you can buy green cauliflower.
And it was served cold, but like with hummus. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it was good.
It had a lot of flavor. And it was a nice contrast to the piping hot food.
Yeah, well, and some kind of vegetable.
But I was trying to read about this because they didn't, you know, it was, I did think it was overpriced for what it was.
Yes.
And then, you know, like a lot of nicer restaurants, you order your, you know, your meat, and then you order your sides. But this restaurant didn't even really have that many sides, and the things that you would consider sides were priced like entrees, and
yes,
they were not. I mean, the servings were very small, and they have the nerve to say like plates to share.
The duck confit isn't a place to share. You need two legs, then you need two duck legs. I'm not sharing like what's to share.
There really wasn't. I wouldn't consider any of those plates as shareable. Our reservation was at 6 at Izzy, but we were seated right next to like another couple sitting in mm-hmm. the restaurant who I found interesting. It's the dynamics of people on a date.
Oh my God.
It was this man and woman. They were clearly on a date. And if I had to guess, I would say maybe that was their second date.
Yeah, they were comfortable enough, but still trying very hard.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the lady in particular.
Yes.
Oh my God. I don't know if she was trying to earn her free meal. I don't know what she was doing, but she was putting on a show for this man.
Well, they got a lot. I don't know if they've not ordered food like that before, but it seemed like they...
They ordered way more than we did, and I thought that we ordered quite a bit.
Yeah, we didn't need more. But I mean, the thing about this restaurant is the proportions are wildly off for some things. Because you could get because they got the hen and the sea bass, and you got, that was a whole fish and a whole chicken with biscuits.
Right. Yeah. It was really odd, like how they.
Like how you get, so you can get a whole Cornish game hen or whatever, and I get one duck leg.
Well, for $40, I get a little bitty leg. Okay.
I should have gotten two legs.
Yeah. But I was reading more about the restaurant because it felt like you could call it Southern, but it really. I mean,
that's why I chose for us to go there, because I was curious about that. But to me, and again, we didn't try the raw bar or any of the seafood, but it didn't have a Southern vibe to me.
No. Well, and then because then you sent me the information, and I I didn't bother to read much about it until we were on our way. And then I thought, oh, it's like soul food. But really it's not. It's like it says, soulful Southern fare. It definitely feels more gourmet. Like that's what they're going for. But yeah. Anyway, I was trying to read like, who is this chef? Because everyone in the kitchen and like the manager, the only black person was our server. So yeah. I'm like, who started this restaurant? The chef and co-owner is a white man.
Oh.
And then
at Joyce.
And the other co-owner is this married couple, a black man and an Asian lady. And so then I'm like, well, where'd the name Joyce come from? Joyce is the name of the couple, the black man and the Asian lady. Their daughter's name is Joyce and her grandmother's name is Joyce. So Joyce, this like soul food restaurant that has pictures of black women.
Yeah. I was like, is one of them Joyce?
Yeah. Cause there are these huge portraits, like three big portraits in the restaurant of black women. Joyce is the Asian lady's grandmama. So Joyce is an Asian lady, old Asian lady. I don't have a problem. No. I don't have a problem with any of this. I just think it's really funny that it's, it just feels like a very, sort of like modern take on things. It's like, you know, when you go to Venice, we used to go to this Mexican restaurant in Venice and it felt very much like, oh, you know,
which one
like
was that?
The one we used to, the one across from Whole Foods.
Oh, Lincoln. Isn't that on off Abbott Kinney?
No. Well, it's close, but it's off Lincoln.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When we used to go with a couple of friends.
Something Lindo.
Is it no, Cielito Lindo is in Olivaro. Off Olvera Street.
Yeah, oh yeah.
No, but you know, it's kind of what you would expect, like a Mexican restaurant in like a predominantly white upscale area where yeah. It's like it's kind of spendy. It's like, you know, they use words like authentic and that's the place one time I ordered pozole and they brought the pig's foot in the bowl.
I know, I got the pig's foot in my spoon.
Like in all the Mexican food, like in all my experience of Mexican food at every place I've been, no one has ever brought me this pig's foot in the pozole except this old upscale Mexican restaurant in Venice.
Yeah, but we were with my mom. You know, they did. I remember liking the artwork in that restaurant, though.
It was a very cute restaurant.
Well, because there were depictions of like violent Aztec massacres on the wall.
But it's just interesting. A lot of these restaurants that are like fusions of things. And I think it's lovely because it's showing sort of the evolution of society and culture, right? Like more cultures are sort of blending and there's a greater appreciation for different cultures. So I think it's really nice.
Yeah.
But they're manifesting in these overpriced restaurants that have like uncomfortable seating and are hard to get to, right? Because they're in these like densely populated areas that don't have convenient parking. So it just kind of feels like, would I go back
to Joyce?
Would you?
I liked my food, but again,
I liked my food too.
It felt like a special occasion place, though.
I think because of the, you know, parking again, because I just parked at Whole Foods and it wasn't an issue, that really isn't a big deterrent, but I don't know.
I think the best thing though I liked was that cornbread. And I make homemade cornbread, but whatever was in that butter, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, the butter was super salty and had some sweetness to it. And then I had put, I have to say all the food was very hot except for the dish that was not intended to be. But the way the butter melted onto the cornbread, it was very salty, very buttery, decadent.
Decadent, yes. I want more of that, but I can probably make that.
Moving on to films released we didn't cover,
Jean Du Barry, which I wrote about exactly a year ago because it opened the 2023 Cannes Film Festival, directed by Mai Wen, whose films I don't usually care for as a director. And notably, it starred Johnny Depp as Louis XV, who falls in love with this, whatever she was, a scullery maid, and their romance that scandalized the courts. It's not very good. But there was of course, an uproar because of the Johnny Depp controversy and then him showing up on the red carpet. I don't know why people were so mad, but they were, I guess. And then around the same time last year, Mai Wen had spit in a waiter's face, I believe, was the news story.
Oh, that's right.
But it's not. It's definitely not a good movie.
The Idea of You.
Let's table that because I did watch that without you.
Oh.
With Anne Hathaway.
Oh, so that means we're going to talk about it on the podcast.
Oh, yes.
Oh, so I need to add that to the list so I don't forget.
It's on there.
It is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't see it. On the movies you watch for fun?
Yeah, it's at the very last one.
Oh, you're right. Administration,
bills and loans. Yes, Madonna. Come with me.
Turtles All the Way Down.
I had absolutely no interest in this, but Hannah
I like Turtles. I like Turtles.
Hannah Fields directed it, who we watched something with her, Banana Split. I don't know. She's a young woman and her work ethic is impressive, but I don't think I'm interested in this film.
Tarot.
You know, this is one of those films. Sony, the press screening was at 10 a.m.
On
Thursday, the day that, you know, because you can see early screenings on Thursday night. So that's always a bad sign.
To give context, the last time I went to a Sony screening at 10 a.m. the day of, that was for Fantasy Island, I think.
No, you did it for 65 as well, the Adam Driver movie.
Oh, also not a great movie.
And I think I did that for the Pope's Exorcist.
I don't know. Like, it's so obvious when they do that this movie's going to be shit.
Yeah, like...
like, why even bother? Just don't even screen it.
Yeah, right. Like, so you're going to make me trek over to fucking Culver City at 10 a.m.?
To get a three-hour head start on the shitty movie.
Yeah. So, no, I think I had much preferred that, because I'd seen it already and was curious of your thoughts. I saw the TV glow instead.
I rarely watch film reviews on YouTube, but I did watch one. There's the very, very popular YouTuber, Jeremy Johns. I watched his review of Tarot and he thought it was shit. So,
directed by Spencer Cohen and Anna Hallberg. One of them wrote Moonfall, speaking of terrible Halle Berry film.
Oh, next, Evil Does Not Exist.
This I reviewed out of Venice last year, and I am a big fan of Ryusuke Hamaguchi, who's probably best known for Drive My Car. I prefer Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. But this is probably my least favorite of his films. But again, it's worth seeing. It's about, and I think it won an award out of Venice. It's about a small family in Japan, or a father and daughter in Japan. They're part of a small community in this luxury camping company wants to come in and kind of take over, and it would cause a lot of changes to happen. And it's about kind of the community rallying about over what they should do.
Mars Express.
This sounded interesting. It is a animated film directed by Jeremy Perrin, and it has a lot of interesting people that I like in the voices, including Leah Drucker and Mathieu Amalric. I think they're married. Yeah. If you like anime, there's a new title of interest.
Next, Slow.
This I reviewed out of Sundance 2023. And it was Lithuania's official submission for Best International Film, I think, this year. But it's directed by Maria Cavatards, and it's about a couple, and one of them identifies as asexual, so it's them trying to kind of navigate that between them.
I watched a documentary about asexual people last year. It was interesting because, like, watching couples who, like, neither has any interest in sex, it from what I remember, it was more about, like, other people questioning them.
Oh, sure.
Which is like, if these two people are fine,
then let them
stay
out
their business.
Then let them be. Let them. I mean, they're probably saving so much time and have so much less anguish.
But of course, the ones who are trying to interact with people who don't feel the same, of course, creates a lot of interesting scenarios.
Oh, and what's a new term I hear more now? Gray sexuals.
What does that mean?
I don't even remember.
Oh,
but the.
Is that like demisexual?
Kind of.
Doesn't demisexual mean you're supposed to have like a...
kind of like a...
intellectual connection?
Yes.
Okay, gray sexual?
Isn't that also sapiosexual?
It's... oh, gray sexuals within the asexual spectrum.
They are
also, they experience some level of attraction. Girl, come on. I'm such an I'm gonna be one of those old men who's like LGBTF elemental P, like
well, I just don't know how much you have to whittle down classification on everything, you know, that you feel like having sex today and not tomorrow. I don't know.
Yeah, like, I mean, it just seems like there's this. So then is there like a constant barometer that you need to announce the reading of? It's like, oh, so you're just not super. I don't have any expertise in this. I'm not a sexual therapist or research whatever person, but this sounds like.
I think we can just, I don't know. Is it because we force people to explain themselves? And again, I like, it's, you know, it's like what I love about the German language is they have such specific words for meanings and feelings and situations, because I think English doesn't quite have a lot of words that to really drill down and describe some things. But at the same time, why are we always having to explain ourselves to the nth degree?
I'll table that.
Okay.
Till after we take a small break. But continuing with the next movie, Something in the Water.
I know you wanted to watch this. The publicist even offered me a screener, and I said I'd take one, and she didn't send it. But another shark movie.
Oh, I wanted to see that.
I know you did.
I mean, the trailer looks like it's going to be garbage, but I probably still would have enjoyed it.
Yeah. Haley Easton-Street, I believe, a debut. Yeah.
Unfrosted.
Jerry Seinfeld directed this, a Netflix release.
Oh, the Pop-Tart movie.
Yeah. Isn't Melissa McCarthy in that?
Oh.
I thought you said you
wanted to. I was trying to think of something Ozempic and Pop-Tart, but I couldn't.
you can have as many as you want on Ozempic, can't you?
Lastly, Wildcat.
Ethan Hawke directed this, I believe, starring his daughter.
Okay, now we can take a break.
Oh, yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
As people may know, I hate listen to Neil Brennan's podcast, Blocks. And a while back, I had said, like, I would love to hear from licensed therapists about what they think about this show, Blocks, which is, for people who don't know, Neil Brennan's a comedian who did a comedy special talking about his mental health. And then now he has a podcast where he brings on famous people to discuss their mental health issues. And he, in his way, therapizes them and pontificates about things and shares the same three stories about him and ayahuasca and DMT. And anyway, I find him like unbearable, but I can't stop listening. So I guess I'm a hater. Anyway, I manifested having a private conversation with a therapist about Neil Brennan and his podcast. So this person is a friend.
Uh-huh.
So we got to have a nice happy hour with the therapist and her husband, who's a good friend of yours.
Yes.
And our old friend.
Yes.
And good friend.
Yes, both.
Mm-hmm. But so we decided it would be fun to listen to an episode of his. So we went back into dug in the crate and listened to an episode from a year ago of Neil Brennan with Hasan Minhaj.
Which she chose. Not to drag her, but she didn't listen to more than 20 minutes of it.
Well, I mean, that says a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I felt very validated because the therapist didn't even get through the episode because they were kind of annoyed by this person. And I think the four of us all agreed that it was grating. So
I think I would actively avoid Hasan Minhaj now.
Well, there are two things that I got from the episode that made me think about whatever we were talking about in the films release we didn't cover that I just lost track of, but that I was going to reference. Oh, about gray sexuality.
Okay.
But anyway, I'll get back to that. But what you just said, people say all press is good press. And I mean, maybe in this current, you know, in this day and age, but I don't know, Hasan Minhaj. I didn't know who he was before listening to the podcast, and afterwards I thought I would actively avoid him and anything. He was so obnoxious, so pretentious. I mean, the definition of trying too hard.
Oh yeah.
I mean, and so out of touch. So then you have these two people who are so full of themselves, and it felt like a dick measuring contest. Like they were just jerking each other off, but also talking over each other. So just not relatable content.
Well, it's just Neil Brennan, you know, it's like these two successful comics, right? And to be successful in any shape, way, or form in the industry, you know, it's difficult. You should be, you know, applauded for sticking it through to the end and following your creative vision. But these two, it's like we have to just brown nose about these specials. And Hasan Minhaj, he's like, oh yeah, I was 30 and I did this brilliant special about being obsessed with the prom. Girl.
I have to mention, I usually listen to blocks, but for this episode I thought, oh, I'm gonna watch it, because every episode of the podcast is like the actual recording is available on YouTube. So I thought, oh, I never watch it, let me watch this one. And immediately, because I think Neil Brennan looks like I don't think he's a cute man, but immediately when I saw him in this interview, I thought, oh, I hate his hair, I hate it. And then what's the first thing out of his mouth when the interview starts? He tells the audience, oh, you might notice my hair looks really great today. It's because my guest has great hair, which Hasan Minhaj does have nice hair. But I thought that was so funny, because the first thing I thought when I saw Neil Brennan's hair was, I hate that haircut. It also doesn't match his style or personality.
In the bitch fest that we had, the private bitch fest about this, I didn't even get to something that really rubbed me the wrong way in this interview was, Hasan was, he's preparing to make a movie and he's reading a book by the great Sidney Lumet about making films. And he's just like, you know, I'll never, you know, all these classic films, I don't have the time to watch. Murder on the Orient Express, the original one that Lumet directed, I'll never have time to watch that, because they both agree that they've learned that whatever's most important to them is their own creative project they're working on. And while part of that is true, it's also like, so you're just never going to make an effort to look at what some masters have done in the craft that you're experiencing beforehand. So you are going to create something, and then, so shouldn't we all have the same attitude about your bullshit? Like, who's going to watch your, don't you want people to watch your bullshit at some point?
Right. But getting back to the gray sexuality, at a point, Neil and Hasan start talking about this idea of being terminally unique. Mm-hmm. And how insufferable that is. Mm-hmm. While listening to two people be insufferable was mind numbing. But so then getting back to gray sexuality, I think that maybe that's part of it, is that people want, you know, as Janet Jackson said in The Velvet Rope, we all have this need to feel special. And I think that's part of that. Like, you know, people want to be defined, and,
oh yeah,
you know, people push back against labels, but then people also hold on to those markers as like something that makes you special. And I
think this week we were talking also a lot about autism because of this interview we listened to, and Amanda Seales, of course, which actually I took an online autism test. But
it turns out it's low probability Nick is autistic. My diagnosis, remains the same, that you're just difficult. But
you kept saying that I'm like Amanda Seales, and then all of these things I heard Mr. Brennan say, I was like, God, should I take this test? But I was curious. But part of that Neil Brennan thing was they were talking about these autism tests and that how people answered them based on the result that they desire to get, the diagnosis they want, and this notion of these 20-something privileged white women trying to skew their answers so that it shows up that they have autism because it makes them feel special.
yeah. And getting sidetracked again, but I think at one point Hasan Minhaj says one of his blocks is ADHD, and Neil Brennan goes, oh, when were you diagnosed? Oh no, I'm self-diagnosed. And then, I thought it was ironic that Neil Brennan is telling him like, oh, well, you shouldn't self-diagnose yourself. So says the comedian who acts like a therapist on a podcast to, right, you know, a large audience. But yeah, I think a lot of that is happening too. Like, and I'm not a healthcare or mental health care professional, but I think it seems like a reasonable person would agree that self-diagnosing can be dangerous because you could misdiagnose yourself.
Well,
and so then a real underlying issue could go unchecked, or people who self-diagnose often self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And then we know that can be a problem because I manifest in all kinds of weird things.
Or you can self-diagnose and get on a very popular podcast and talk about your diagnosis, even though it's not real. And then that causes a strange cultural ripple effect.
Well, the last thing I was going to say is I think people use these self-diagnoses to excuse behaviors.
Yes.
Because that's a very common thing I deal with, is being told like, well, I have anxiety, or and this is why I'm doing this thing, or this is why I'm acting in a way that you find unsavory. And it's like, you know, that may be legitimate or not. Either way, to me, it doesn't matter. Like, to me, it's an excuse. And you know, I don't like excuses. Like, that can be very real for you. And that's the thing that you're dealing with. But I still don't like it. And I still don't want to be around you. And I think, but anyway, going back to the gray sexuality, I wonder if it's a lot of these markers and labels are just people trying to be unique and special. And
well, because think of that, if you tell somebody you're gray sexual and then have sex with them, then that makes them feel like they were special because they were able to conjure these kind of feelings that are rare in you.
Or that, or it also sounds like people covering up for, you know, inadequacies, or not being able to be mature enough to just say, like, I'm really not into this. Like, and right. That's not necessarily their fault. I think society, you know, certain cultures, certain demographics where sex is a bigger deal, you know, with younger people, with queer people, you know, there are certain demographics where it's the topic of conversation often. And so maybe a lot of people feel pressured to.
Well, it's very, especially I think in the gay community, sex is very desensitizing.
Well, and it's also something that I'm, you know, I'm constantly forced to talk about and be approached with and explain myself. And I think I could see people using these markers as a way to deflect, which in some way is like self-preservation. So I'm not totally shitting on it, but, you know, it's the result of, you know, people constantly being confronted with something that should be more personal, maybe, but it just seems odd that people will announce like their sexuality or their sexual preferences. Like, I'm not interested in having sex with you. We haven't had that conversation.
Right.
So it's a little jarring sometimes when people sort of announce their sexuality to you. And I don't mean like their sexual orientation, but more like the specifics of like
what they get down with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like, oh, okay, I'm not interested. I don't want to have sex with you. So I don't know why you're telling me these.
I would like, we were talking about Joyce Carol Oates. And now I know that you like fisting. Okay.
But anyway, moving on to projects of interest, The Secret Agent.
Yes, by a Brazilian filmmaker I really like, Kleber Mendonça Filho. You've seen Mr. Filho's, some of his previous work. You've seen Bacurau, which we reviewed, and I love Aquarius. But his next film is going to star Wagner Moura, who you just saw in the film Civil War.
Occupation.
Oh my God. So apparently Miroslav Slabishpitsky, Ukrainian filmmaker who was the talk of Europe and all of Cannes in 2014 for his film The Tribe, which is excellent. And he hasn't done a film since then. He's had all these failed projects. He was very infamously filming something in Chernobyl that I think didn't – the years spent on that I think never – there's some interesting stories behind that. And then apparently he's still developing something with Aronofsky's company, The Tiger, which at one point was going to star Brad Pitt. But now it's been announced, all these interesting projects are coming out because Cannes is around the corner. So these hot market items are hitting the trades. But apparently this is based on a news article, and it's about a family whose house is shelled during the war in Ukraine. So
Power Ballad.
John Carney, who I like. He did that song with Bono's daughter last year, that Flora and Son, that I think we both really liked, and several other films, usually musical related. But Paul Rudd is attached to his latest, and so is Nick Jonas.
Flesh of the Gods.
Isn't that a great title? Panos Cosmatos, who you should all know for directing a great Nicolas Cage film called Mandy from 2018 has announced his next project. Apparently it's a vampire film starring Oscar Isaac and Kristen Stewart. Miss Stewart must not be directing her feature anytime soon, because it's also been announced that she's going to star in the new Kareem Anouz and Albert Serra film. All of those people, well, yeah, Anouz can be exciting. But Stewart with this vampire movie and Albert Serra, that's very exciting to me.
Alpha.
Okay, Julie Ducournau, who directed Titan, which you've seen, which won Cannes in 2021, she's announced a new film, which is very exciting. And Tahar Rahim and Golshifteh Farahani are attached to star.
The Ballad of a Small Player.
Edward Berger has announced his next project. He previously did the new adaptation that everybody that got a lot of attention of All Quiet on the Western Front, but notably Colin Farrell and Tilda Swinton will be in his latest.
This week on our Patreon, we reviewed Moon Age Daydream, which is an experimental documentary about David Bowie that was released like 2 years ago.
2022. Well, it premiered, it came out last year.
And we also reviewed the horror comedy, The Cabin in the Woods, starring Sigourney Weaver. Unfortunately, there is an entry in the obituary section.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Paul Auster, an American writer and film director, died.
Yeah, he has a trilogy of books I always meant to read. I never did, called the New York Trilogy, but maybe next time I'm in New York, that'll be impetus. But yeah, he died. He was 70... How old was he?
7.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's take another break. This week's secret film was your choice.
Yes.
And you chose the 1979 American epic war film, Apocalypse Now, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes.
Why did you choose this film?
Because I will be seeing his labor of love, Megalopolis, and from the production of Apocalypse Now, I feel like there might be some similarities, but and I haven't seen this since I was a kid, so it just felt like the timing's right, and it is a very notable film.
I didn't know anything about this movie. The title I had heard, so I like if someone said what is Apocalypse Now, I would have known that it's a movie, and I guess if you ask me what do I think it's about, I think I probably could have conjured that it's probably about the Vietnam War.
Sure.
Maybe if I would have known that it was made in the 70s, then maybe I could have conjured that. But yeah, I didn't know who was in this movie. I didn't know the vibe of it. But the premise, a U.S. Army officer serving in Vietnam is tasked with assassinating a renegade special forces colonel who sees himself as a god. I would call this epic. I mean, it's like an epic fantasy war film.
Well, yeah, I mean, first we probably should mention that it is sort of based on the 1899 novel Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, which is about colonialism in Africa. So Coppola has transposed that onto American interventionism during Vietnam.
The film stars Martin Sheen and Marlon Brando. Robert Duvall's in the thing. He was nominated for an Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
We have little Lawrence Fishburne in there.
Oh,
Dennis
yeah.
Hopper, Harrison Ford's in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
The story is very simple. Martin Sheen is this military person who's approached to do a special mission, which is to go kill Marlon Brando, this colonel who's sort of gone rogue and is talking crazy, and the military is hearing all these stories about weird stuff he's doing. He's also been charged with murder for like sanctioning the death of
four
Vietnamese people,
double agents. Yep.
So the government wants him like eradicated. So they send Martin Sheen on this mission. Martin Sheen commissions a group of soldiers to get him on a boat and get him to Cambodia, where Marlon Brando is hiding out.
Mm-hmm.
And Oh, I should have mentioned. So there are multiple versions of this film, and you made me watch a 3-hour version.
We watched the final cut version, so which is shorter than Redux.
And so for about 2 hours of the film, it's just, not just, because it's pretty spectacular, but it's Martin Sheen with his crew going up the river and all the things. This movie felt like the Wizard of Oz to me, kind of.
Or even the Odyssey, you know. So,
yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, some fantastical story, but a very familiar, like, people go on a journey and all the experiences, and then when they get to their destination and confront the thing, like, what do they learn about themselves? You know, it's sort of that framework. But of course, you know, I think the brilliance of the story is building up, is how it builds up to meeting this figure, this Marlon Brando, Colonel Kurtz person.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's almost like they're really journeying into hell.
Yeah. And then, so of course, Martin Sheen gets there. All of his crew end up dying except for one. And then Martin Sheen confronts Marlon Brando, kills him, and then turns around and leaves.
And that you're saying that a lot faster than what happens.
Yeah. But I'm doing it to show that it's, I mean, the basics of it are pretty simple, but
yeah.
What are my overall thoughts? The cinematography is I was trying to think of a word to describe it. And I don't know that I can find a word that I think.
It's stunning. It is so, that's what's funny about it, is it's a horrifying film, but it's so beautiful.
I don't know that I think it's beautiful. Because I can think of other films that I think are more beautiful. I think that every time, like every shot of the movie looks like, it's just brilliant. Mm. I don't even know how a person could create, like how do you even make a shot list for a movie like this?
Right. Well,
because I can only imagine they filmed like countless hours and like just every time you blink, it looks like a photograph.
Mm-hmm. And I think this film almost ruined Coppola. There's a documentary that his wife co-directed, who just died, called Hearts of Darkness, which came out in 91, which is about kind of how difficult it was making this movie, including the stars themselves. Brando showed up like overweight, as he was wont to do then, and didn't know his lines. And Martin Sheen apparently not only had a heart attack, but a fucking breakdown.
Well, I was reading a little bit about the casting and how, you know, Coppola started out wanting a whole bunch of different other people besides the ones who were in it. But then, you know, people wanting more money that was being offered, or people not wanting to shoot on location because they were afraid of getting sick, or they didn't want to be gone that long. So, I mean, I can only imagine. And then just the conditions of the shoot look, from the looks of the film, I can only imagine how arduous it was.
It looks like a grueling effort. And I think he had to edit something like a million feet of footage or something.
I believe it.
It is so gorgeous. But to me, that's, you know, in the Bible, they say Satan was the most beautiful angel. That's kind of what this film is representative of.
Is that why you call me evil all the time?
Because you're so beautiful. I just call you beautiful. I don't need to call you all that.
You don't call me beautiful.
You call me difficult. So I don't know.
Well, of course, this is an epic film that many, many, many people have talked about. There's, of course, that documentary, Hearts of Darkness. So I'm going to go through my little notes then, because I can't say anything about this film that hasn't been said. So I'm just going to say things the way I say them.
No, but it was a pleasure to watch it with you. Someone for the first time, in the awe of, because my dad showed me this when I was a kid and too young to understand a lot of it. And then I had to read Hearts of Darkness in college, along with Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, and talking about the, it's so fun to revisit this film. I think it is breathtaking.
The opening of the film is a shot that I think we see later on, but it's a shot of like the jungle being bombed.
Did that remind you of Tropic Thunder?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, Tropic Thunder clearly.
Well, because of that, snafu where their explosives go off too early.
Yeah, but I think the opening shot is taken from a shot we see later. Mm-hmm. But what an amazing start to the movie, because then it sort of blends into us seeing Martin Sheen in a hotel room.
in Saigon
going crazy. And, you know, this is before this term was used, but, you know, I think it's safe to diagnose this person with PTSD.
Notably, he breaks the mirror in his room, which I think this is a film all about him seeing himself or coming to examine his interiority.
Oh, I didn't even think about this till just now, but we did. I've talked about the diagnosing sitcoms and movie podcast before, mm-hmm. and we've done two episodes with them.
Yes.
Oh, we did one on their channel and they did one on ours.
Yeah, Wedding to Exhale and the Terrence Howard Hustle and Flow.
Hustle and Flow. Anyway, they recently had a special guest on their podcast. They reviewed the film Antoine Fisher. I know it's Antoine, but I like to say Antoine. Yeah,
Yolanda Ross is in that. I have not seen that film.
I haven't seen it either. But apparently it's about a military, Denzel plays a military psychologist. And so for people who don't know, the DSM podcast features two licensed therapists, two black women. And it's a great podcast. Yes. I recommend it. But they had a special guest for the Antoine Fisher review, a military psychologist.
Wow. Well, yeah.
And it was really good. And she was very candid about sort of like how she was trained and how they handle certain diagnoses. And I would highly recommend that podcast. And I don't even know why I didn't link the two, but especially after watching Apocalypse Now and hearing this woman talk, this therapist, mm-hmm. it super, super interesting. But anyway, getting back to Apocalypse Now, I'm going to go through my notes. Mm-hmm. Martin Sheen reminded me of Rob Schneider.
Well, he's got those big, his eyelashes are so long.
In some shots, he's a little bit of a snack.
Yeah, he's cute. He's been in so much, and I think he's kind of a bit underrated, but he reminded me of somebody I went to college with as well. But what was I going to say about him? Oh, sometimes he looks like a little boy.
And then sometimes he looks like a little boy. Yeah. Of course, Harrison Ford looks great. It's because it's, you know, he was younger.
Primetime Harrison. Yeah.
When the officers who are, or the, I don't know what they're called, generals, the people who are commissioning Martin Sheen to go assassinate Marlon Brando, they're telling him what they need to do, and they're playing a recording of Marlon Brando talking, and he sounds insane, which of course is like more proof that we need to get rid of this guy. But we hear someone say, I don't know if it's Martin Sheen, but someone is talking over saying, charging a man with murder in this place is like trying to give a speeding ticket at the Indy 500.
Yes.
Like, damn.
Well, because that's the thing. That's just an excuse to get Kurtz, because he's not doing what he's acting in a godlike fashion when the U.S. military is the god.
During the scene where they're trying to convince Martin Sheen to take this mission, there's an actor named Jerry Zismer, who I think his character name is Jerry, maybe. Mm-hmm. He had the worst hair, and I thought he looked like Jim Parsons.
Is that with the bang? The man with the bangs? Oh, yeah, those bangs were really ugly.
We have to talk about Robert Duvall.
Before we get that scene, though, what's really striking is that when they're talking to Martin Sheen, that they have that little monologue about good and evil.
Oh,
which I think is also setting up themes of the film, as in sometimes good doesn't always win.
Hmm. Okay, Robert Duvall's playing this officer or colonel, or
lieutenant colonel
who. At first, I'm like, this man's crazy. But then it's like, this movie's crazy, and he fits right in. But his performance is pretty, I mean, he was pretty captivating.
Oh, my God, yes.
And he's like, because at first I'm like, oh, he seems like such a dick. But then you realize that he's kind of cool. Like,
yeah, he's a good person, but he's also in this insane environment. And
he's insane, and he's obsessed with surfing. And there's like, I mean, I would say the best scene in the film is... he is saying, oh, tomorrow we're going to go to this area because we need to like find some
bad guys.
And
well, they have to transport Sheen's team to the boat to get on the river.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we can go to this place. And then there's this rant about how the water's good for surfing. Mm-hmm. There's also one of the people who's going to go on the trek with Martin Sheen, who's the only one left at the very end.
Sam Bottoms, yeah.
And he's like this sexy surfer. And I thought his name, like the actor's name, is funny. Mm-hmm. Sam Bottoms. But anyway, I think the best scene is them flying into the area. And then Robert Duvall going crazy because he wants to go surfing, forcing people to surf while they're being attacked. Then we get that huge explosion that I think is used in the opening. It just, it's like, what, 25 minutes?
Yeah.
And it's just, it looks so good.
But like bombs dropping everywhere, explosions happening everywhere, and Duvall is not flinching.
Not flinching. He's crazy. He takes his shirt off at a point. Like, I'm ready to go surfing. And he's apologizing to the sexy surfer. Like, I really thought the water, but like the napalm is affecting the waves. And that's where we get the famous line of, I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Yeah. And Martin Sheen trying to navigate this.
And then him trying to figure out, like, how do I
get Lance away from the lieutenant colonel?
At one point, Robert Duvall screaming, like, you either surf or you fight. So then we have like two guys in the water surfing
while they're
while bombs are being dropped on them. I mean, I don't, that section of the film is, like, who came up with that? I mean, it's just so
well. It's almost like,
well done.
It's almost like the middle of Triangle of Sadness. Like, it ascends to this greatness of,
yes,
like, this is so good. And then of course Martin Sheen steals.
Martin Sheen finally gets away on his boat, but he decides to steal the surfboard. And then we see that, like, later that night, while they're like hiding out in the river, like in the jungle swamp water, we see that the colonel, Robert Duvall, has his people in helicopters flying around, and they're playing, like, on the loudspeaker, a message from Robert Duvall that says, you know how hard it is to find a board you like?
Just give it back. I'm not going to hurt you. Give it back.
I'm not going to hurt you. I mean, that's, by that point in the film, that's when I realized, like, oh, I'm in, like this fever dream. This is like a nightmare. This shit is crazy. Mm-hmm. Okay. There is the actor who plays Chef.
Oh, Frederick Forrest, who you know from The Rose, which we just watched recently. And he was nominated for that this year. Those are the same year.
I thought he was cute. He reminded me of Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
But he says that his career is that he's a sazier, which is a real thing. Like in French cuisine, it's the person who specializes in making sauces.
I heard that and I feel like I missed out.
Which I thought that could be a career Nick would be good in. Oh, yes. Nick loves sauces and he will waste time creating sauces to.
Oh, yes. That's an alchemy. There is.
Speaking of what people look like, little Larry Fishburne's in the movie, who's like 17 or 18. I thought he's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah.
But I thought he looked like Keke Palmer.
Oh, well, didn't he play her daddy?
In Akilah.
Akilah the Bee? Is he? No, he's a teacher. No,
he's the one training, coaching her.
But he was cute. But yeah, the first frame, I'm like, I know he's in it and I didn't recognize him. But I think it's because the shot even, because he's also in a Rudy Ray Moore film, I think, is it Human Tornado? Which I remember feeling he's very recognizable in. So I think this shot earlier.
I would watch this movie again, like, if they have like a big, like IMAX big screen version, because it just is so spectacular to look at, because they're on this journey on the river and every, like, all these shots of like these, you know, like plane jets that have crashed, fighter jets, and like the rubble of warfare, and like they're just going, and then there's the use of like smoke, like different colored smoke everywhere, that I thought was so effective. Because it did feel like a nightmare.
Yeah.
But another crazy scene is all, like, just like we're going through this scary river and then all of a sudden we come upon like this production and it's a USO show where we get these Playboy bunnies. And I thought that was just like
madness.
It was literal madness. And then, of course, who thought it was a good idea to get all these young men who are like
horny and think they're going to die?
Don't have access to women. I mean, unless they're assaulting the native women, but
yeah,
like, so then of course these three Playboy bunnies get out there and get these men riled up to the point where like they have to like flee on a helicopter then we see two guys hanging from the helicopter.
One of those women is Colleen Camp, who you've seen, you probably recognize more as an older woman.
There's a sad scene where they're almost to Cambodia and they see some boats, and the captain of the boat,
Albert Hall, who's very good in this.
He is very good. And his death, I got a little teary-eyed.
Him and Fishburne's death, they're very well done, very emotional.
Oh, well, we'll get to Fishburne's death. But there's a point where they see up some boats and the captain's like, listen, we need to check if these are supply boats. Like, and they go and they end up like shooting and killing a woman, all because she was trying to like protect her puppy.
They thought she was hiding something.
And then Sexy Surfer takes the puppy, and it's just like, oh my God, this is insanity. We also see that the boat, they get mail. How do you get mail on those boats?
Because the person that was in charge of delivering that knew that they were going to be at that last outpost, that last bridge.
You know, that post office, people know the post office I'm talking about, because every time I mention it, I get messages on Instagram. But there's the post office, which is where we have our P.O. box, in West Hollywood on Fairfax and Santa Monica, that has the worst service ever in the world. I'm convinced. But I was thinking, like, these nasty bitches at that post office who are so rude, and then you think in this movie, Apocalypse Now, someone got packages to these men on this boat on this river, and they did it with a smile.
And like, just has to call out in the darkness, is there a Captain Willard here? Like, oh, yeah.
I mean, that's someone who cares about their job.
Well, think about the Pony Express. Jesus, how difficult it used to be to get shit around.
We learned that, so Martin Sheen's given a dossier, and we sort of, and he's fed information as the trip goes on, like by the mail he receives. But at a point we learn that there was someone who was hired to do what Martin Sheen was hired to do,
which is Chris Scott Glenn,
who did like 6 months ago, and he went out there, and then he ended up like converting to Marlon Brando's, you know, because it's almost like he has a cult.
Yeah, it's very Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, it's as creepy. Well. Oh my gosh. So Lawrence Fishburne, he gets a package, and it's like a recording from his mom. And he ends up their boat gets attacked, and Lawrence Fishburne gets killed, and we watch him die while the recording of his mom is playing.
Well, she's talking about him coming back.
Oh my God. Like, that was so well done.
Can I say though, Scott Glenn, when we only see him briefly, I don't think he has any dialogue. He was a snack back then.
I only remember the one shot of him.
I'm sure you don't remember him as Jodie Foster's mentor in Silence of the Lambs.
I actually do.
Okay.
So we watched this long ass version that this is my first time seeing it. I don't know what parts were cut from the original, but I can assume that a scene that was cut that I did not think we needed was when they get to this French plantation.
That you're right. That was cut.
Oh my God. It just was so long. And I think I understand what it was trying to do, which was like, since it is a fantasy, maybe this was like supposed to be, because we also see Martin Sheen have sex, like have this rendezvous with one of the French women.
Aurora Clement.
But it just felt so drawn out. And then we have the one French guy having this tantrum about how the French like lost all these battles, and so they're not going to leave this area because they won here. And I think it really fucked up the pacing and the energy.
It does kind of bring things to a standstill, but at the same time it breaks up all the boat scenes. And I like how it looks as well, but Christian Marquand, I think it could have been edited down a bit more, but I don't mind it. There's the sex scene where they're smoking opium. Martin Sheen and Aurora Clement, I think, is kind of sweet and creepy, because she puts all the what do you call it, hanging around the bed,
the mosquito nets,
the canopies,
yeah,
and she's naked and she's kind of pushing herself through the net, and they're both high as hell, and she's repeating a line about how there's kind of two people in every one. I don't remember the line she said though, but there's two people in you, a man who loves and a man who kills, which is arguably on the nose, but when you're fucked up and think you're saying something profound, I think that's how people sound. It also reminded me of, there's a scene that I really like in a Guillaume Niclot film called To the End of the Earth from a few years ago. It's Gerard Depardieu and Gaspard Ulliel, rest in peace. And having rewatched this now, and that's set in the Indochina War, 1945. To me, I think that Niclot was mimicking this scene.
I'm trying to get through this because time is limited, but when the pilot or the captain of the boat that Martin Sheen is on, when he gets killed and Martin Sheen's holding him, the captain tries to strangle him. Is that what you got?
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. Why did why that choice to show that? Because then Martin Sheen kind of has to like finish off the captain of the boat.
Yeah.
So that was a little sad. Okay. The opening of the film and towards the end, we seem, well, more than I think we see it three times in total. We see Martin Sheen. Is he dancing or?
Yeah.
What is that about?
He's doing some kind of calisthenics. I think he's lost his mind a little bit.
Okay. Well, that would make sense. Uh-huh.
I think he's had a little breakdown.
So when Martin Sheen gets to Marlon Brando, Marlon Brando basically keeps him in like a fever dream, literally. Like he just kind of keeps him locked up, but not. Like not against his will necessarily. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start to see that Martin Sheen maybe kind of is buying what Marlon Brando is selling. And
well, and they both have similar lines about lies and how they can't stand lies, that this war has warped them and the men that have caused it are all lying. And he, like halfway down the river, Martin Sheen says he thinks he knows a thing or two now about Kurtz. Like he can understand him.
We see when Martin Sheen first, he doesn't really get captured. He's just kind of held. But when he first gets held, he's like actually held in like a jail. And we see Marlon Brando bring him the head of the chef. So oh, yeah. Then he killed the chef. I thought Marlon Brando reminded me of Daniel Franzese from Mean Girls.
Oh my God.
So when Martin Sheen kills Marlon Brando, he's basically hacking at him like with a blade. Mm-hmm. And while he's doing that, we see that the people
outside are doing the
are
same
doing
thing
that to
an
a
ox.
Water buffalo
or a water buffalo, yeah.
And I was reading that was a real water buffalo.
Oh my god, that's so disgusting
but,
to see.
But apparently, like the indigenous people had already planned a sacrificial,
sure,
I mean, like, ritual, so they kind of coincided. But yeah, when you see it, like that's a real
that scene. That water buffalo.
It was so disturbing that I thought it was fake because it's like that can't be real.
They are slicing right into that animal.
I know. And then I think the worst part of it is when you see the water buffalo kind of collapse.
Like
the look
alive.
On its face is like, you got me, Gail. Like, that bothered me.
Yeah.
Of course. So in the end, we realize that Marlon Brando, he realizes that it's his time to go and he wants to go out like a soldier. And then it almost seems like maybe Martin Sheen thinks that he might take over. We also see that in some of Marlon Brando's like writings that he's written, drop the bomb, exterminate them all. Mm-hmm. Which I was a little confused by, like, because I didn't know, maybe it has multiple interpretations, because I thought, does he think that this space needs to be eradicated, or did he want no one else to run it like him?
I think it's both.
So
because he knows that he's amassed these people together and controls them in this way, but he is also ultimately meaningless.
But in the end, when Martin Sheen gets the transmission to give the coordinates to drop the bomb on the region, he blows it off. Mm-hmm. So it would seem like Martin Sheen thinks that this space should live on, but then we see him leave with the sexy surfer. And then, of course, the film just ends, or not of course, but the film ends. So, of course, we don't know. Like, I mean, their trip up there was arduous. So then immediately I thought, are they going to make it back?
I think you get the sense they might not. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't think Martin Sheen's going to make it back alive. We only have like 2 minutes left, but what would you give this movie?
It's a 5 out of 5 for me.
I feel like I have to give it 5 out of 5. I wish I would have watched the theatrical version.
Sure.
Because I think my impression of it, like that French plantation scene kind of, I actually had to stop the movie and take a nap. But up until then and then after, I thought it was riveting.
It's, sure.
It's such a unique story.
Unique
in that, you know, I mean, it was inspired by someone else's writing. But like it, yeah. I mean, this feels like why I'm like, this is what movies are meant for.
Yeah, I agree. It won the Palme d'Or. It won Best Sound and Cinematography Oscars. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Notably, the president of the jury, Francois Sagan, this author, was told ahead of time that you will be picking Apocalypse Now as the Palme d'Or winner. And she refused. And they threatened to publish her drinking activities.
Oh, God.
And so that year, there were two Palme d'Or winners, this and the Tin Drum.
Oh, well, I think this is deserving of accolades for sure. Mm-hmm. But if a person's never seen it like I hadn't, I think a way to convince me to watch it, like if I hadn't been forced to, would say you need to watch it for the cinematography. It's just spectacular. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you haven't seen anything like this in decades.
No, things are not made like this.
No one makes movies like this anymore. And it's And Coppola makes a little cameo in the movie point as like a journalist who's filming warfare. But that's all I have for Apocalypse Now. Yes. Good job, Coppola. Mm-hmm. We also like your wine.
Oh, and Peggy Sue got married.
Your daughter's a little annoying, I think, though.
Oh, yeah. Wait till you watch Godfather 3.
We have some things that are coming out next week. I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have to watch a few movies next week.
Yes. But we'll see Furiosa before I go to Cannes.
And I know the reviews for Hitman.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And that Amy Winehouse movie, Back to Black.
Yep.
And then, yeah, we're seeing Furiosa. Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes, yep.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No.
Ta-ta.